This week on Out of the Air features Professor Elizabeth Gingerich discussing Lakeshore Public Media's viewing of the American Revolution on April 22nd at Valparaiso University. Next, an artist specializing in epoxy, resin, and wood, Thomas Smiley, who creates artistic furniture and wall hangings. Our spotlights on Marshall J. Gardner Center for the Arts March exhibit featuring Roman Villarreal with Executive Director Julia Gibbs.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, WVLP, 103.1 FM, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is heard every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org. And is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Also heard on Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at WVLP.org. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Media. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. I'd like to welcome to Art on the Air Spotlight back again from the Marshall J. Gardner Center for the Arts, and that's at 540 South Lake Street in Gary. And they have millerbeacharts.org. You can find out information there, 219-885-9114. We will give you that information at the end of the segment here, but we have Julia Gibbs, the executive director, and she's going to tell you about an upcoming exhibit, which is March 20th in April, and maybe talk about some of the through April and also some of the things that have been happening. Julia, welcome back to Art in the Air Spotlight.
Thank you so much for having me. Hi, Larry. Hi, Esther. It's great to be back.
It's great to see you, Julia.
Thank you. I'm excited to talk about our upcoming exhibit that I'm actually curating. So in March, we're going to open a one-man show by the artist Roman Villarreal, and it's called Roman Villarreal, The Gift of Shaping, Works in Painting and Sculpture. And that runs from March 20th to April 24th, with an opening reception on March 20th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the gallery.
And so what is Roman's type of art? I mean, you sent us a thing, but I know he's from South Chicago. But tell us about the kind of things he has in his exhibit.
Yeah, I'd love to. So Roman's a self-taught sculptor living on the south side of Chicago. He's a really prolific maker who's been creating work since the 1970s. He's a former steel worker, and he raised his family on the south side of Chicago, where he still lives today with his beautiful wife, Maria. And a lot of the subjects around his life really occupy the majority of his artistic work. So you see a lot of things around urban and family life. Roman considers his art a recording and history of life on the South Side. So it's reflecting on people and places and life experiences of his community. And there's also a really strong element of his Mexican heritage within the work as well. Now, our exhibit at the gallery spans decades of his artistic practice. There's a variety of media that people will see, paintings in acrylic, sculpture in wood and stone. He has very unusual media here, from marble to alabaster, and as unusual as foam and even soap in his work. It's really, really fun and playful and beautiful work. So in particular, people will see a lot of themes of a family and family relationships. And one thing I love about Roman's work in particular is that people are really used to seeing this theme of mother and child and Madonna and child in artistic work. But Roman purposefully flips this on its head because he feels that fathers are underrepresented in art. So there's some really beautiful pieces in the show that are portraits of father and child, fathers in family groupings, fathers with their children together. I find them really beautiful and really excited to see him kind of express his own relationship with his family and his feelings about fatherhood through his artwork. People will also see a lot of expressions of urban life, dancing, musicians in clubs, hanging out on the street, and also a little darker commemorations of urban tragedies. But in general, Roman's work is very colorful and playful. Some things I love in particular in the show as well are his reversible paintings, paintings that can actually be positioned in different ways. So you see both the front and the back or the side, they're all painted so you can move them around. And the scale of the pieces is also really interesting. They go from everything from minute, the tiny soap sculpture, as I mentioned earlier, that you can hold in your hand, they're so small, to monumental. And one thing I wanted to mention in particular, speaking of the monumental, is that Roman's actually a really well-known artist in Chicago and has a number of public works. So not only can people come to the gallery, but they can see his work out in the world. Two in particular I wanted to mention. His Tribute to the Past is a sculpture that's been installed at Steelworkers Park on Chicago's southeast side. It's around Lakeshore Drive and 87th Street. And so that sort of speaks to his past as a steelworker. And out here in Indiana, just last January, he had an installation of limestone turtles placed at the Indigenous Culture Trail, which is at the Indiana Dunes Visitor Center along Route 49. And they're really, really beautiful and very significant in a way. In fact, that, you know, they're made of limestone, which is indigenous to our area. But the turtles are also an incredibly important symbol to the Potawatomi people who live here as well. So people can see his work out in the world. His work is also in collections, the Mexican Museum of Art in Chicago. He's had a major retrospective at Intuit Museum in Chicago in 2023. So I think when folks come to see the show, they're going to see a very significant regional artist, whole body of work. As I said, he's been working since the 1970s.
Wow.
So Julia, about how many pieces are represented?
Right now, I've got about 80 on the list. By the time we open the show, we may have had to scale it back a little bit. But again, they vary in size wildly. So it's everything from very large scale painting and sculpture to minute tiny pieces you need to get right up on top of. And before we run out of time, I wanted to mention also that we'll have an artist talk with Roman on April 12th at 2 p.m., and that's really worth coming out to. Roman is a great storyteller. And as an artist, he's also an incredibly generous individual. He's been a mentor to many younger artists, including the CISA group, crazy InStyle artists, who are actually the people who painted the murals in Miller Beach. So we have a very strong connection with Roman and with the people he's mentored over time. We're excited to have him here.
Well, that's a wonderful exhibit. It's a Roman Villarreal, and it'll be at the Marshall J. Gardner Center for the Arts, 540 South Lake Street in Gary. And you can find out more information at millerbeacharts.org. That's Julia Gibbs, Executive Director. Thank you for coming on the Air Spotlight and sharing.
Thank you so much for having me. I hope to see you at the opening.
Yeah, thank you for another winning exhibition.
Art on the Air Spotlight and the complete one-hour program on Sunday is brought to you by Emberforge Consulting, with end-to-end expertise in learning strategy, design, and implementation. Emberforge turns your organization's knowledge into impact. To learn more, visit emberforgeconsulting.com.
This is Janet Davies, formerly of ABC7 and now the Dunes Arts Foundation, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media 89.1 FM and on WVLP 103.1 FM.
We would like to welcome Elizabeth Gingrich to Art on the Air. Elizabeth teaches graduate and undergraduate courses in business law, international trade and governance, sustainability, and digitization at Valpo University's College of Business, and is editor-in-chief of Valpo's International Journal of Values-Based Leadership. She brings nearly three decades of law experience into the classroom. She has lectured at national and international conferences on renewable energy,
and intellectual property, and her work has been published widely. She is a member of both the Indiana and Virginia State Bar Associations and maintains a limited practice in corporate real estate, probate, and tax law. She also currently serves as an elected official on the Center Township's board. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Elizabeth. It is wonderful meeting you.
And you as well.
Well, Elizabeth, and we've worked together on the Lakeshore Public Media Board, and actually we're working on this event, but on our Art of the Wear feature interviews, our audience always wants to know a little bit about your background before we get into that. So tell us a little bit how Elizabeth got from where you were to where you are now.
Certainly. I'm a professor of business law at Valparaiso University, and I have been so for over 25 years. At the undergraduate level, I teach business law using my own textbook. And then at the graduate level, I teach international trade and governance. So hot topics these days. In addition to that, I'm a practicing attorney, have been for 40 years, predominantly in real estate, wills and trusts, and taxation. In addition to that, I am the editor-in-chief of the International Journal of Values-Based Leadership, which began back in 2007, and it features academic articles, government interviews, case studies from all over the world. So that is a daily chore, but a chore of love. I'm also I've got a weekly radio program on WVLP 103.1. It's called Culture Wars. Every Thursday morning at 11 a.m. Let's see, is there any more time left?
Oh, you got plenty of time.
No. In terms of what else do? I don't sleep, yes, currently preparing for the April 22nd event at Valparaiso University Hari Union in the triple ballrooms upstairs. This is from 3 to 5 p.m. This will show segments of the American Revolution, Ken Burns's probably magnum opus, and released at a time that could not be more formidable, in the 250th celebration of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. We will show segments. We will have facilitators. Those will involve James Old, who's chair of the Department of Political Science at Valparaiso University, Natalie Krivas, who is a professor of English. She's also a dual native of Canada, especially, well, Nova Scotia, and the United States. And so she comes to this with a unique perspective in terms of the involvement of Canada in the American Revolution. Then we've got Anton Lewis, who teaches business at Governor State University in Illinois. He is a dual resident and a dual citizen of the UK and the US. So he's got an incredible British accent, and there's nobody better to introduce some of these battle scenes. Then there's Richard Sevier, who's Dean of Humanities at Purdue Northwest. So we've got quite a lineup. And Meg Tillemans, who's head of Indiana Humanities, a program director, and of course, Nancy Clifford and Larry here from Lakeshore Public Media. So 2-hour affair, again, 3 to 5 p.m. on April the 22nd, Triple Ballroom, Hari Union, VU. It is free. We always ask for donations for Lakeshore, but it is free. But you need to reserve your place or places. And just contact me directly, Elizabeth.Gingrich. And Gingrich is spelled G-I-N-G-E-R-I-C-H at valpo.edu for your reservation. There'll be light refreshments throughout, too.
And you know, we'll have your picture on the website with a link to do that and everything. So tell us the background of how this came into being. Obviously, the American Revolution and Ken Burns films are well known. And as I've said, we're going to be interviewing his co-directors on that in another segment. But what was the germ of making this all happen?
Well, here's the thing. It was released November of last year. So, I mean, it's still relatively fresh. It's amazing how many people haven't heard of it yet. But I've seen every one of his documentaries, from the Roosevelts to the Civil War to the Holocaust and country music and the Bison, everything in between. This one just absolutely garnered my attention. And I usually don't watch anything. I have things on the background while I'm working, but this one was an eye catcher. And I just had to watch it over and over and over again because it revealed so much history. And as an undergraduate history major, it's amazing how much I didn't know about our own roadmap, our place. And so in terms of things that we see as well, just in our own towns, you know, traveling around Valpo and you see Lafayette Street, Washington Street, Jefferson Street, Franklin Street, and you just see these as streets. And then all of a sudden their names rise up to this predominant roles in the American Revolution. And so and things like, I mean, people that you might have heard about, I sure knew it from the high school in Indianapolis, and that was Crispus Attucks. Who was this person? And this is Black History Month, right? And so this was actually the first person to be shot and killed in the American Revolution. He was the first victim of the Boston Massacre. His ancestry, he derived from indigenous peoples and Black slaves. So he has a very unique role in this. And again, there's so much history. Last year, I was doing hydroelectric research out in the Northeast and traversing Lake Champlain and going up and down the Green Mountains in Vermont, as well as the Mohawk Nation over by the St. Lawrence Seaway. And I was just doing this from a clean energy perspective, but watching the American Revolution, it's like, oh my gosh, I was there. I didn't realize the significance of this place. And in so many places, from Princeton to New York to Saratoga to Lexington, and then all the way down south to Savannah and Charleston. It's amazing, again, how many of these locales and how many of these people that we learned about in grade school were dynamic personalities in the American Revolution. Now, this is a six-part series. Each episode is approximately 2 hours long. If you want to get hooked right off the bat, go right to episode 2 and watch the first 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. And that will make you want to go to the first episode and then watch the whole thing through. What I'm going to do in introducing this on April the 22nd is provide, because so many students will be there, college students, and this is Generation A now, Alpha, Generation Alpha. They were all born after 9/11, and their sense of history is a little bit either skewed or non-existent. But just give them some nomenclature. Who were these parties? Who were the rebels? Who were the patriots? Who were the loyalists? Who were the colonialists? What was the Continental Army? Other names that I really did not ascribe to the significance of this event was Benedict Arnold. It's like everybody knows Benedict Arnold. You don't want to commit one
but
of those.
The end. They know the end of Benedict Arnold, not the beginning.
They do, but just not his evolution, where he started, and West Point. We all know West Point is a military base, but how was Benedict Arnold associated with West Point and George Washington? And then the fact, the overriding fact, especially when you get to the end and you process everything that you've seen, that basically the development of this country was on stolen land and using a kidnapped workforce. It's basically what it comes down to. This is land that was taken. And attaining land rights was a dominating, motivating incentive for those coming from Great Britain and settling in the in America, in one of the 13 colonies, at least to begin. It was all about the prospect of getting land rights, especially since so many of those coming from Great Britain did not own land. They were indentured servants, basically. They were serfs. And so the prospect of gaining land ownership and striking out on your own was so intoxicating that when Great Britain issued its proclamation, because the settlers were starting to get a little bit antsy, that you could not move beyond the Appalachian Mountains. That was Indian land. Well, my gosh, all of it was Indian land. But But then you saw that this was a motivating reason for, again, the Continental Army, the militias of the 13 colonies, to say, no, land is the driving motivation for us. We're going to go west. And so, you know, Britain, we're going to get rid of you. So we're not going to have anything in our pathway other than the rightful owners. So when we learn about just how much we derive from just two massive crimes, and the fact that, yes, George Washington was a brilliant general, a brilliant diplomat, but he owned people. And so did Jefferson. They owned people. Washington had 100 slaves at any one given time. And so when you're shouting the word liberty, and then you hear your enslaved population say, yeah, then it's all of a sudden, quash that. No. We got different levels here. So you just see the evolution of all of us. And we cannot be deaf and dumb to our beginnings and what we inherited. We have to embrace the history fully. And like I said, for every negative, there's a positive too. But you have to, again, bring it all in and learn it and embrace it. And just again, understand this too. Democracy, the achievement of democracy was not the original objective of this documentary. Okay, this was started, 10 years ago? And actually, I believe that Ken Burns really wasn't planning this for that to be released around the time of the 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. But it came about, and it wasn't until, 1787, after the Confederate Federation, when Ben Franklin was asked, so what government, what kind of government, what form did you come up with? And his reply was, a republic. If you can keep it, it's fragile. What are we doing today? You know, we're facing again backlash against immigrants who built this nation originally. We're facing a backlash of the appropriate workings of our three branches of government, Articles 1 through 3 in the U.S. Constitution. And Article 1, giving the most power, basically the most emphasis, the most focus on the legislative branch, on Congress. And so you expect Congress to act.
Right.
Again, equal three branches of government. Are they really engaging in checks and balances? Are we really coming to the precipice of what Franklin did warn us? If you can keep it.
Well, and the thing about the Declaration, too, is they were declaring it for white men that had property. I mean, that was the idea of it. And so the Declaration, and of course, that carried on to when they did the Constitution years later. It was a different concept. And like you said earlier, it was about land and control of their own destiny. And you also brought up about Washington, and his brilliance as a general was not so much in the offense, but in the defense. He realized that if he got captured, or his army got captured, the revolution was over. I mean, whatever they were doing. So he was great at sometimes of tactical retreat that kept this war going. And it was important to do that. And let's talk about
He was persistent.
He was persistent. And that's important. Let's talk about, we're showing segments during this. So talk about the actual structure of the event itself.
Sure. Well, what's going to happen with the four main facilitators? They're going to introduce individual segments. Now, the entire piece is on the military. There's so much violence. There are so many battles that really encompass the American Revolution. We think it was like when we signed the Declaration of Independence, it was over. It had begun the year before and it went on till 1783. And these were bloody battles, and they were fought on various continents. And so, yes, these are different battles. This is basically focusing on the military aspect, of which there is much in this series. And so, you know, using Natalie, Dr. Krivas, to again talk a little bit about the battle. America invaded Canada. I had no idea that it happened. Again, I thought that was just now. But America actually invaded Canada and fought British forces there. And then at the end, with the signing of the peace treaty, what happened to the remaining expats? Well, they were shipped up to various islands in the Caribbean, shipped back to Great Britain, and many, along with freed slaves, were sent to Nova Scotia. Well, Natalie Creevis is from Nova Scotia. She's got that edge. So, again, we've got our British speaker who's going to introduce the Battle of Bunker's Hill, the Boston Massacre. And so we've got Richard Sevier showing who composed the Continental Army. A lot of people don't understand. These were not just these moneyed white property owners. These were poor. These were slaves. In fact, you could put somebody else in your spot if there was the draft, and the draft did happen. So sub out. And so again, Richard Sevier is going to concentrate on that. And then James Old is going to begin the segment of two other battles. But he is going to come to the, he's going to basically cover the introduction of how did we get to these three branches of government? And why is that important today? So each one of them will be introducing a mini segment to each. The entire length of the this particular segment we've been allocated is approximately 50 minutes long, and it's broken up into 8 to 10 minute segments. So
Elizabeth, is there room for questions?
Yes, and so we've reserved at the end, once we're done showing this, then we will go into the audience. They're seating for 340 people at round tables. And so the facilitators, we will have we've got question lists on the tables. They can begin the discussions. And then our full facilitators, including Larry and myself and Nancy and Megan, will come and, around the tables and, again, make sure that conversation is flowing and to be that precipitating rod, to make sure that if they don't understand some of the topics that were covered. So there should be, and then, like I said, there'll be refreshments for 2 hours. And so I think it's going to go very, very quickly. I teach a 4-hour class every Tuesday night. It's amazing how quickly that goes. So two hours with 8 people and 340 participants or audience members. This should be rather lively.
It's so interesting because I also watched with my finger on the rewind button because I had to go and re-listen to, you know, things that were sort of shocking, or I needed to hear it more than once.
As a champion of John Adams, I always think of what Abigail's writing when they're talking about the Declaration and the period. It says, "Don't forget the ladies, John," and because what a remarkable relationship they have. I think about their correspondence, pre-revolutionary, post-revolutionary, throughout their lives, and it really, that type of thing doesn't exist nowadays because of electronic email and things like that. But the remarkable thing of a woman who really never had like a formal education beyond what we call high school was well-read and yet brought such interesting perspectives from the women's point of view.
Well, she was a woman without voting rights, without land rights, none of those rights. And so, again, as she was quite esoteric, in fact. Right. What I like about what Ken Burns did and has done before, but in this documentary, in terms of those who he features face first, we're looking at historians that are Black, who are Native American Indian, who are female, who are male, who are British, who are Irish.
And who are then, children.
And the voices that you hear, if you look at the credits at the end, the voices that you hear are all the A-listed actors, from Tom Hanks to Meryl Streep, and in the UK and Ireland as well. So again, he incorporates those who basically have a different experience coming into the American Revolution, which was a global event, and it set the course of history. And so, again, we're seeing this as a parameter. I mean, there really weren't republics back then. So this set the tone. It provided the example. It was the shining light. And where we go from here is really up to all of us.
Right. Well, and also the documentary, they were inventing a type of government that really did never existed prior to that. I mean, a democratic republic, and that, where you are no longer a subject of a ruler, you are a citizen. And that was a whole new concept.
Oh, completely. They decided no kings, no monarchies.
Exactly. And what they had back in Great Britain, they had three branches of government, but one was the monarchy. And so they wanted to ensure that those three initial articles of the Constitution set up these three distinct branches. But again, right. Article 1 is dedicated to Congress, elected by the people.
Right. Hereditary succession.
Well, even Washington said, don't give me more power than what was intended. He did not want that overriding power. He did not want to be George the Fourth. And so he was delimiting his own, place in history. And when Larry mentioned about his persistence in battles, I mean, he was tall, extremely tall. How is it that everybody around him was shot and killed in some of these battles? His horses were shot and killed. He had bullets through his helmet, but he was unscathed. He believed spiritually that he was tagged for this role.
Right. Well, I think so too, and it's remarkable too that George Washington stepped down from the presidency, stepped down from the army, even at the end of the Revolution, and I think it was King George of England remarked how remarkable that was, that he voluntarily gave up that type of power.
Exactly. Yes, and so, what do we do with it now? I guess that's the question that should be left in anybody who watches it, anybody who comes to this event. What do we do with it now? Is this the American Revolution Part 2?
Exactly. Yeah. Well, we have just about a minute left. Let's recap how people can find out about the event, where they can go, websites and things like that for the April 22nd event.
Sure. Go to Lakeshore Public Media and you will see, again, there's a QR code that gives you more details. You can register through Lakeshore. You can register through contacting me, elizabeth.gingrich@valpo.edu. But reserve your place and please do this early. You can do this for a guest. If you have students, if you have clients, let me know. We'll see what we can accommodate. But again, those spaces, this is early February. This is the end of April for this event. They'll go quickly.
Exactly. Well, I appreciate you coming on Art of the Air and sharing about the event, which, of course, I will be involved with. American Revolution is at Valpo University, April 22nd. You can go online, lakeshorepublicmedia.org. There's a code there and to register. Elizabeth Gingrich, thank you so much for coming on Art of the Air and sharing about the event.
Thank all of you, too.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much.
Certainly.
This is Allie the Piper, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM.
We would like to welcome Thomas Smiley to Art on the Air. Thomas is a skilled artist specializing in epoxy resin and wood, with over a decade of experience creating artistic furniture and wall hangings. His foundation in woodworking began at a cabinet shop in the 1980s. He holds a Bachelor of Science in Mechanical Engineering from the University of New Orleans. Following a distinguished 30-year tenure with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, he retired in 2021 and returned to Indiana. He then established Resin Art Interiors, dedicating himself full-time to producing unique artwork and participating in art festivals and exhibitions. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Thomas. It's really wonderful meeting you.
Hi, thanks. Appreciate you guys having me on.
Well, appreciate you coming on, and we'll talk about your origin story, but also we saw you at the For the Love of Art Fair and appreciate you coming on and didn't get you on before. But, our origin story means how you got from where you were. I know what Esther said, but we want to hear your version of it, where you were born and things like that. So tell us how you got from where you were to where you are now, Thomas.
All right. Well, I was born in a small town in Indiana called Rushville, 5,000 people. And I was exposed to art in my family quite a bit. My mom was very much into art. And my older sister, who was 13 years older than me, did art shows her entire life, she recently passed away, but she really got me going with the, got me exposed to the art shows and the art lifestyle, I guess. So I credit her with giving me a start.
So what did she start you out with? Was it drawing or painting or?
Well, yeah. I mean, like I said, well, my mom had friends that give art classes. So we did, you know, we did, she liked to do oil painting. So I've done the whole gambit and I did acrylic on canvas that I have in my house. I don't do that stuff to sell or be out there. But so I kind of fell back on my woodworking background, like you said, with a cabinet shop back in the 80s. And that really got me going, got me the woodworking bug. And when I got out of college and retired, I had enough money and I'm old enough and I have enough gray hairs to buy all the tools and equipment I need to do wood shop. And then I saw the resin, you know, online, and I thought that was pretty cool. So I started dabbling in that. And it just took off from there. You know, I self-taught as far as I try something. If it didn't work, then I'll try it a different way. So I've really got it down to a fine science now, where I do the river tables, any kind of thing. I do unique pieces, a lot of Lazy Susans, and stuff like that.
You know, one question I have is, and this is just kind of going off of your non-art career, is, and thank you for your service in the military, but tell us a little bit about that part of it, because that's a major part of your life. If you were there for 30 years, where did you serve? I know it was U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, but tell us a little bit about that before we move on to back into your art.
Sure, that was, I wasn't actually a active duty military. I was a civilian working for the military as an engineer in Army Corps of Engineers. The Army Corps of Engineers is 95% civilians. So I was an area engineer, did a lot of cool projects there. I moved around. I started in New Orleans with the Army Corps of Engineers there, and then went to San Antonio, and then went to Germany, and then came back from Germany and went to New Mexico, and then went back to Germany kind of thing. I did a 6-month tour in Afghanistan. I did a 6-month tour in Kosovo. And so when I do those things, I'm boots on the ground, overseeing construction. So I oversee, construction contracts, military construction contracts, making sure the contractor is doing what he's supposed to do and checking his stuff and making sure he gets paid and that kind of stuff. So it was very, very fun, and I enjoyed it. But when I came back and retired, I actually found a house in the next small town next to Rushville that really had a nice wood workshop that really fit in well. So I ended up moving. I'm 20 miles from where I was born. So I went a long way around, but here I am back.
Excellent. Hey, while we're still in the Army thing, before we move on, any unique projects that we would want to know about that you worked on?
Oh, yeah. Probably the most unique is a missile defense system in Poland. a friend of mine said, when I was telling them that, they said, oh, okay, you're in charge of saving the world. I got it. So not quite that bad, but we built the infrastructure for this military missile system, and the missiles that they built are normally shot off of submarines or sea vessels. So the facilities we built look like a top half of a submarine sticking out of the ground. It's kind of weird looking, but that was my most interesting. But other than that, I did hospitals, in New Orleans. I did civil works projects for levees and flood walls and that sort of thing.
So I kind of want to talk about middle school, or maybe even earlier. I just want to go back. I have a few questions. So did you pick up woodworking from family at an early age? Because I know, like, in seventh grade, I had shop. So, yeah.
I had the shop thing too, but that's not really where I got going with it. But go ahead. Yeah, some more.
Yeah, no. So, was that something you did with your family? Maybe did you build things with family or
no? You know, no? I was in my early 20s, got out of high school, screwed up every college in Indiana before I actually settled down and graduated in New Orleans. But so I was just floundering around, and a friend of mine had told me about a job opening in a wood shop, a cabinet shop. So I jumped on that. I think I made $4 an hour or something like that, but I didn't really care at the time. You know, I was just happy to have sawdust in my veins again. So that was really fun, and I really loved it, but I couldn't quite make the bills at $4 an hour.
That makes sense.
So how did you come upon your current style? What was the first piece that you did?
Well, you know, as probably all woodworkers start off with, you know, cutting boards and stuff like that. I did that as well, but then, you know, that you can only do so much with that, and it's all been done to death. So when I saw the resin and added that to my work, and that really made it stand out and unique. And I do kind of unique things with resin that a lot of the resin artists don't really do, with my coatings and my edges, and different things like that. But, so that's where I got to where I am.
So how did you get connected to For the Love of Art Fair? You were just in there and everything. So tell us about how you connected with Shireen and, you know, exhibiting there.
Well, that's all on Shireen. You can blame her for that. And she saw me at one of my other art shows. I think it was the Penrod here in Indianapolis. And liked my stuff and approached me and said, hey, I got this great show up in South Bend. We'd love to have you as to participate in it with us. So she approached me, and I gladly accepted, and that was last year. So this year was my second year that we just finished up. So that year was last year, and I did great at that show, my first show. I actually got a very large commission from one of the other artists at the show. They saw my work and said, hey, we're doing a Kenshin Island. We want an 8.5 foot long, 4.5 foot wide countertop for our kitchen island. But they want it live edge and all this stuff. And I said, well, I can do it. That's probably bigger than I normally do, but that sounds like a challenge. So I did it. It came out great. And my son and I delivered it. I ended up making it out of red oak, which is heavy as heck. And then it was 2 inches thick, and that thing was very large. So luckily they had a contingent of brother-in-laws and sons and people to help us. So it was quite the community mission getting it in the house and mounted in the kitchen. But it worked out well. And then I also at that show sold 2 different tables that are on my higher end of my pricing of things I do. I usually sell a lot of Lazy Susans. And I've actually started kind of dabbled into bowls now and other things. So I'm trying to keep myself interested and quit and not doing the same thing and over again. And it really gives me a wide range of things for people to look out. And people, you know, people are amazed when they come by my booth at any of these shows. Or you saw my stuff at the show, and it's very impressive to look at. It doesn't come across in pictures too well as it is in live. So people have a lot of comments like, wow, and I've never, ever seen anything like this in my life. And stuff like that, which, you know, kind of makes me feel good.
You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media 89.1 FM on WVLP 103.1 FM.
So is the resin food safe? when you're talking about kitchens and bowls?
Yes, it is. It's food safe. It's not heat safe. And I say that about my bowls because I make these bowls that were 100% resin. First thing the ladies asked me is, can I, you know, put it in the microwave and this and that? And no, it'd be just a puddle, I think, if you did that. So I warn everybody not to put those
hot pots on the counter.
Right. And as far as the countertops, I put an extra coating on those and tables that they aren't so susceptible to damage from heat or anything for that matter. I just tell them, just treat it like your countertop at home. I mean, you wouldn't take a serrated knife and start cutting up a ham right directly on your counter. So don't do that on my table and you'll be fine. So, but as far as food safe, it's fine. You can put food right there on the table or in those bowls, but just not heat it up in it.
Right. You also do wall art. Tell us a little bit about the types of wall art that you do.
Well, it depends on the pieces, the slabs of lumber I get. Whenever I have several sources online, and they specialize in these live edge slabs. So I'll go online and they'll have a picture of what they have in stock. And I'll be able to search for different kinds of woods and price ranges and thicknesses and that stuff. And then when I find something that looks interesting to me, I'll just put it in my cart and pay for it. And they ship it to me just like Amazon, really. I probably pay a premium for doing it that way, but I know I'm getting good wood that's dried and, you know, it's not, you know, people think I'm traipsing out in the woods looking for fallen trees. And if I had a nickel for every person that has a tree in their backyard that fell down, they want me to come chop it up and make art out of it. I'd be rich, but that's not something I do as well. I tell people I got people for that. And that's the people I get my wood from. Lumber, the sawmills is what they are.
You talked about lazy Susans. I mean, I don't know if a young generation, I know, I'm sure Esther and I are familiar with that. But tell us about the lazy Susans that you make.
Well, that is kind of, when I first got in it and kind of incorporated the resin, you know, the most things you see online are the river tables and river this and put a little river of resin down the middle of woodwork. So I said, well, let me try that. So I had two pieces of wood with live edges on both sides and I put them together, put the resin in the middle and I had, so it was basically a square with a strip of resin in the middle. And I'm like, okay, this is great. This came out great. What the hell am I going to do with it? You know, what is it? I just wanted to make it. I didn't have a long-term plan on what to use it for or what to sell it as. So what I ended up doing is rounding off the corners and made it just a oddly shaped lazy Susan. But I put that mechanism, the turntable mechanism underneath and it actually sold pretty good, pretty quickly. And so then I started going down that road of experimenting with different things and different ways of making these lazy Susans. And what I ended up doing was I found the water pans on a big planter or something. They have the pans underneath the planter. I found some of those that are plastic and the right size that I wanted. So I used those. I bought a stack of those and I use those as molds and it really worked out well. So I just now I just cut my wood to fit in those round molds and I just experiment with different colors and putting different things in it. People bring me stuff to put in them that have some meaning to them, rocks and whatever. So I've had people give me everything. This is the tree that fell down in my grandmother's yard and slabbed up. And these are rocks we found as kids. So they put, actually, the only thing I added was the resin and the expertise of putting it together in the artistic way, I guess. So, and then on my website, there's quite a unique story where this young couple saw me at one of the shows and they said, well, we have this tree that we got engaged under You know, and they ended up cutting it down recently, and they saved us a little piece of it. Could, if we bring that to you, can you make a table out of it for us? I said, sure. They said, it's pretty gnarly looking. It's all nasty and cut up, and it's been sitting around. I said, well, I know it's going to be ugly, but I'll make it pretty. And that's what happened. And once I planed it down and sanded it down, it turned out to be actually it was beautiful wood, number one, but it turned out to be two trees that had grown together, and you could see the bark in between them. And so that was kind of nice that they, you know, they, that was represents their marriage. So that turned out very well.
Is there any kind of art that you want to do outside of woodworking? Now, you talked a little bit about, you did some acrylic painting before, that you're not, but is there something else that, yeah, I really like to do, whatever that might be?
Well, you know, I see in my travels in the art shows and stuff, I see other artists and I see what they're doing, and I say, well, what can I do? How can I use that in what I do? So, you know, one of them was copper. You know, they're using copper to make different things. So I kind of thought about that. I really haven't got into that yet, but it's basically expanding on what I already do. I don't have anything totally different that I want. One, I was across the hall from a booth that sold moss wall art. And so I thought, well, maybe I can use some of that, because I do put art or moss in some of my rivers. So that, other than that, I really don't have a lot that I'm really longing to do.
What do you like to do outside of art?
Well, I have a motorcycle, and so I like to ride that when I can. My household has recently grown from myself and my wife to myself, my wife, my son, his wife, his two daughters, my stepdaughter and her baby. So wow. We have now 8 people in my house. That keeps us quite busy, keeps me quite busy. And just keeping up this property. We have a pool and other things. So just keeping up with this is quite the time killer.
Do you work mostly on commission? Is that the bulk of your work?
No, I wouldn't say the bulk, but that's the bigger pieces are commission. Cause you know, if I make those ahead of time, it'd have to be the right person just looking for that exact thing that I made. So when people see my work, I let them know, look, I can make anything. This is all handmade. I made it. If you want something like this or something different, what I tell them is take a picture of what you're looking at right now. Take a picture of that and send it back to me. Say, hey, I saw this, but I don't want it as Lazy Susan. I want it as a wall hanging, or I want it as a table, and I want it this big and this wood. And that kind of gets me going in the right. That gives us a thing to talk about back and forth, because we'll kind of go back and forth. We want this type of wood or this color wood and this color of resin coloring. And then I'll come back and say, well, that I can do that, or this is what I have. This will work. And so we get, you know, it takes us a few back and forth before we get a plan on what we're doing. But that works out well. I, you know, if I don't do well at a show, I actually make it up usually in commissions. And, you know, I don't know what my percentage is, but, you know, a lot of people say, oh, I'm going to call you to get that. And, you know, some of them don't, some of them do, a few of them do. So it's worked out pretty well.
Thomas, how many shows do you do a year?
Well, I'm trying to cut back. I do probably 6 to 10 in the past, which is quite a bit. And I started doing them out west when I lived in New Mexico. So I've done the shows in Arizona as far as California. And so at one year, I did a little loop in Arizona. There's 3 different shows I used to do. So I did, and they're back to back to back. So I did a little loop and stayed out there in my RV and did those 3 shows and paid for my little vacation.
Well, we're just about in our final minute here. We want to give you a chance to share your website, information about that, how people can reach out and contact you.
Well, I have a website. It's resinartinteriors.com. I don't keep it up very well, but it's on there and it has my information. There's a lot of cool stuff to look at. The piece that I mentioned of the young couple is on there. And then I have a lot of pictures on Facebook with Resinart Interiors. And that just gives you some pictures to look at for that matter. As far as shows, I really don't know what I'm being accepted for and what I haven't this year, but I do a Chagrin Falls show, which is up by Cleveland. And then I do St. James Court, which is in Louisville area.
And you have that information on your Facebook and or website then where you'll be?
Possibly.
Well, I understand. Sometimes it's hard to keep all those things up and going.
It is.
Well, our guest today was Thomas Smiley. He was at For the Love of Art Fair this year and sharing his work. He's specializing in a poly resin wood work, beautiful work. You can see his work at resinartinteriors.com. And if you're interested in the type of work he has there or maybe something you'd like to do as a custom order, get in touch with him. Thomas, thank you so much for coming on Art of the Air and sharing your art journey.
Great. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
We'd like to thank our guests this week on Art on the Air, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is heard Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Art on the Air is also heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP, 103.1 FM, streaming live at WVLP.org. If you have a smart speaker like Amazon Alexa, Google Assistant, or Apple Siri, just tell to play Art on the Air to hear the latest episode. Our spotlight interviews are heard every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Media. Thanks to Dee Dotson, Vice President of Radio Operations for Lakeshore Public Media, and to Greg Kovach, WVLP's Station Manager. Our theme music is by Billy Foster with a vocal by Renee Foster. We'd like to thank our current underwriters for Lakeshore Public Media, Ember Forge Consulting, Thoughtful Marketing and Digital Learning, built to express your purpose and grow your reach. Learn more at emberforgeconsulting.com/grow. And for WVLP, Walt Reitinger of Paragon Investments. So we may continue to bring you Art in the Air, we rely on you, our listeners and underwriters, for ongoing financial support. If you're looking to support Art on the Air, we have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA, where you can find out how to become a supporter or underwriter of our program in whatever amount you are able. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good. You'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. If you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts, arts-related event or exhibit, please email us at AOTA@breck.com. That's AOTA@breck.com. BRECH.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know. Esther and Larry, Art on the Air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the Air, our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.